My pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Deb Culley. Dr. Culley is an attending physician and vice chair of research at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, an associate professor of anesthesiology at Harvard Medical School. Of note, she is president of the American Board of Anesthesiology and serves as the chair of the Academic Anesthesiology Committee of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, in addition to numerous other roles and titles, both at her institution and nationally. So, and she will be talking about postoperative delirium. So without further ado, Dr. Culley, thank you.
First, I'd like to thank you for inviting me to be here today. What a wonderful opportunity, and absolutely, got it. A wonderful opportunity to be here today. I expected to come, didn't know what would really happen. They said, can you talk about delirium and maybe a little bit about, you know, quality improvement, which I'm not an expert in, and maybe how that might roll into MOC. Gotcha, I can do a little bit of that. So it really has been a privilege to be here today and an incredible amount of fun. And I actually learned something that I hadn't learned before, so thank you. I have conflicts. We all have conflicts. The ones that are relevant to the things that I'm going to talk to are NIH funding, as well as the fact that I'm a director for the American Board of Anesthesiology. In that realm, I would be completely remiss in this room if I did not mention that one of your peers, Dr. Benjamin Cloyd, has recently received a FARE grant co-sponsored by the American Board of Anesthesiology, and I'd like for all of us to just congratulate him for being able to do that. So in this large room of really smart people, you really don't want me to bore you to death with all the risk factors associated with post-op delirium, but I'm going to do a little bit of that anyway. And part of that is because it is the number one complication in our older patient population, and we really need to be aware of it and know what those risk factors are. And part of the reason for boring you a little bit is that if we did a little better job of being able to pull them out of a certain thing called a database, so that the average practitioner didn't have to look it up and then flash in front of their face every time that patient went to their preoperative evaluation, this patient has a 20, 30, 50% chance of developing postoperative delirium, we'd probably be doing them a favor. So the things we commonly think about are advanced age, no surprise, pre-existing cognitive impairment, genetic differences, whether or not you have depression, whether or not you have sensory deficits that are not corrected. There are also surgical procedures. Some of them are better, some of them are worse. There are medical issues that you might have, in particular this guy on the far right side under medical frailty, something that is very common in our older surgical patients and really associated with bad adverse outcomes. We talked a little bit today about low oxygen saturations or high oxygen saturations, but delirium is associated with it being low. And other pharmacologic things that you and I do every day in the operating room and really don't think about. You need to look at their medication history, get rid of those things that are associated with them developing delirium. Try to avoid those things like anticholinergics, ketamine. Some people say propofol. I'm not sure that I buy the idea that you have to ignore, pay attention to propofol, but some people would suggest it. And then neuroleptic drugs. Now, I want to get back to this idea of age, because age is a number, and the patient is not necessarily just a number. If you look at this next slide, you will notice that there are two people here that may have a slightly lower incidence of postoperative delirium, despite the fact that they're both at very advanced age. Why? One has been participating probably for lifelong in physical activity, and B, the other one is probably a really smart guy who's cognitively engaged and has been cognitively engaged for a long time. That's my way of saying that there are a lot of things that contribute to delirium. One of them is a major insult versus a minor insult. You have a large surgical procedure, cardiac surgery, you'd expect something to happen. If you had your toenail removed under local anesthesia, you might think that it's a little bit less likely. But then there's those individuals who have high vulnerability, and I'm going to now describe them as individuals with cognitive impairment and frailty as well as being old. And they might have something like a lap apnea, and all of a sudden they just don't do so well. But I've also seen the exact opposite appear before my eyes, not in the perioperative setting, but in my own home. I'm at an ABA meeting a couple of years ago, and my daughter-in-law calls me and says, there is something wrong with your son. He is just out to lunch. I don't know what's going on with him. At the same time, I'm getting a call from him on the same cell phone telling me, Mom, you got to help me. Hazel's trying to kill me. Well, as it turns out, he had Coxsackie virus. He had was about 5 liters down on fluid by the time they got him to the hospital. And after I dialed 911 and got a nice ambulance driver to take them in, they diagnosed them with Coxsackie virus. So there are reasons why even reasonably healthy individuals without large enough insult can develop post-op or otherwise delirium. I had mentioned a few seconds ago, or a few minutes ago maybe now, that post-operative cognitive disorders are the number one complications in our elderly. We do things at our pre-admission testing center. You look for things that are going to detect things like pulmonary embolism, ARDS, stroke, myocardial infarction, pneumonia, death, and heart failure every single day as a part of your practice. But how many of you really look at whether or not a given individual is at risk for perioperative cognitive disorders? So our lab has kind of looked at this for a long time, by the way. Initially, I was kind of a rat doctor, I've transitioned a little, and now I actually look at patients. And we started trying to figure out whether or not cognition was a predictor for postoperative delirium. This is a study that was published a couple of years ago in Anesthesiology. And the details really aren't important other than that roughly 1 in 3 individuals over the age of 65 have some degree of cognitive impairment. That's a little frightening. And these are people who did not have a diagnosis of pre-existing cognitive impairment or dementia at baseline. And that was associated with things like discharge to place other than home, the development of postoperative delirium, and longer hospital length of stay. This is not just this group that has found this. This has been found on multiple times, on multiple occasions. It's also associated with the 1-year mortality. Now, I'm not saying to you that the cognitive impairment is the cause. It's probably the things that are leading to that cognitive impairment and the development of postoperative delirium that are the real issue. This is another example of another group in Boston from Sharon Inouye, where they looked on the vertical axis, so the likelihood of basically developing postoperative delirium. Along the horizontal axis, a cognitive score. The further along that axis you go, the higher your score, the lower your likelihood of developing delirium. Now you're thinking, boy, she's really convincing. This is really awesome. Yep, I got it. There's one problem. All of this work that I've just shown you is done in Boston. 65% of our patients, 65 years of age and older, have at least a college degree. So we're taking those individuals that are primarily cognitively intact and have that educational benefit with regards to cognitive decline, and we're still finding very high prevalences of delirium. My guess is, in some other areas, it's going to be even higher. But it's probably not just cognitive impairment that we're looking for. That's enough of a nebulous term. But what about frailty? Frailty is something that's really interesting. We talk about it all the time. But you know it when you see it, or you think you know it when you see it, but it's really hard to diagnose. You know, there are biologically driven frailty. There's also deficit-driven frailty, of which cognitive impairment is one component. And there have been a lot of things that have been developed over time to try to identify that frail patient. Most of them are these huge, 15-item frailty scores. Can you get up and walk across the room? Well, if you're really old and you're really frail, it's going to take you a long time to do that, and you've just wasted a whole heck of a lot of time, because there are potentially other markers that we can pull out of databases to identify those patients at risk. Frailty, similarly, is associated with the development of postoperative delirium. This is a study that was done by Charlie Brown at Hopkins, a different city. And they found that if you had a frail who was going to have non-cardiac surgery and they were not frail, their incidence of delirium was pretty low. But if they were frail, it was significantly higher. In other words, there are things that we can identify preoperatively to identify those patients at greatest risk. We recently have done a study where we looked at both a cognitive screening as well as a really simple frail scale. You can see it's listed as table 3 on the what would be your right-hand side. Do they have fatigue? Do they have problems with resistance? Can they ambulate? Do they have a number of illnesses? And have they had any weight loss? And it's marked if you have 3 or more of them, then the likelihood is that you're frail. And what you can see here, looking at delirium as identified by the confusion assessment method, if you're frail or have frailty and cognitive impairment, the likelihood that you're going to develop delirium is 50%. That only represented about 15 percent of that patient population, but boy, that's a really high risk group. And if you had cognitive impairment alone, it approached 30. So that's interesting. I put that bottom thing there because this has not yet been published, and anesthesiology gets a lot of, you know, how dare you take so long to get my review back to me. But this particular manuscript has been under review in JAMA Surgery now for 79 days, and we still have not received a report on it. So, Tim, we don't have to worry about being 1 or 2 days late. There are a lot of groups that have gone out there and said, hey, we need to start doing these screenings for geriatric syndromes, things like cognitive abnormalities, things like frailty. You hear it all the time. Doing it and executing it is far more difficult than one might imagine. And you might actually ask yourself, well, why do we need to find it? It's just going to happen. It's just what happens. Well, there's a lot of data out there to suggest that roughly 40% of delirium is preventable. And it's oftentimes preventable by what we would consider simple measures, but implementing them in all of your older surgical patients would be difficult. But if we can identify that small fraction of patients where they've got roughly that 50% prevalence of, or likelihood of developing delirium, we can make small steps at a time to try to decrease its prevalence. And the things you do are really simple. You orient them. You provide them with activities. You make sure that they sleep well, that they're reasonably well hydrated. If they're not eating, you have them fed. Very non-medical things that make a difference to these very fragile patients. Now, do I think we could use something like an MPOG database to enable this to happen? Oh, you bet I do. Other people have done this before. Jim Rudolph is one of my collaborators and a dear friend. He's a geriatrician who worked at the VA Medical Center in Boston for a very long period of time. And he went through and identified prediction rule for delirium. So they took a database, what were the things that went into it. I'm not going to go into the details of what their variables were because it's irrelevant here. We would be using whatever it is that you have. But they were able to come up with an area under the curve of 0.8 for its ability to predict delirium. That's pretty high. Similar things have been done in other areas where they're looking at estimates of delirium in individuals without known cognitive impairment, and you see very similar types of curves there, not quite as high as what Dr. Rudolph saw, but you get the idea that we can identify those patients at risk. One of the problems we have, though, as one of our previous speakers has mentioned, delirium is really poorly recorded in the United States. We don't do routine CAM testing. We don't do routine any kind of delirium screening test. And as a result of that, we're stuck with the results or the numbers that are placed in the chart, usually by the nurse, that says the patient's crazy and pulling out their ID. Oh, yeah, that's probably delirium. But the more frequent type in the postoperative period, hypoactive delirium, the type the nurse is never going to write down. That's that really awesome patient that lays there all day, looks off into space, and requires no additional nursing care. So if we're really going to try to have an impact, we need to come up with a way to identify those individuals that are most likely to develop delirium, and part of that may well require that we have an endpoint that we're actually measuring rather than one that we're getting off from a chart. So the question is, how can MPOG and Aspire kind of do that type of a thing? And so I didn't know whether or not we'd want to do it nationally, statewide, or regionally. I'm thinking about our patients that are 65 and older, and 65% of them have a college degree. I talked to some other group not all that long ago where in their particular practice, 20% had a college degree. So we're all going to be a little bit different. So we might need to develop different practices locally, maybe regionally. But if we could get a national program that was really pushing this forward, we would be in a good position. And it's important because we can do something about it. I really want to bring that one home. It's not something that the patient and the physicians are stuck with. We may be able to do something there. Now, when I talk about or think about, I don't talk at all about machine learning, but I think about it a lot. And I find pictures like this and, you know, information out in, information out. Perfect. But there's a lot of additional things that go into that. And part of the process is that you have to have a very well-defined input piece of information, as well as clean data and a well-defined outcome. And delirium is a little bit difficult in that regard. So I'm going to show you a couple of examples where machine learning has actually been used in anesthesia, and part of the reason why they probably work well. This is where they used frontal EEG in individuals who are going to receive sedation and gave them differing doses of sedation, and sure enough, you saw changes in the frontal EEG. So very well-defined input. They either got no sedation, they got some sedation, or they got more, and a really well-defined output, EEG. They were both measured at that particular point in time. Others have looked at things like 30-day mortality. Simple. Everybody dies eventually, and if you die within 30 days, you're going to be able to get it off the Social Security Death Index database, and we're going to know about it. They've got reasonably good inputs and a well-defined endpoint, and as a result of that, they're able to develop models that correlate with one another very well. And depending upon the modeling that you use for your machine learning, you get various areas under the curve, but most of them are in like the 0.8. I can't even imagine being able to predict delirium with that degree of accuracy. And so I guess my real question for you is whether or not we can do this type of a thing for delirium by putting in, for some patients, a delirium marker in every single case for every single person on a couple of days, a couple of months, hopefully not a couple of years, so that we can define those variables that would allow us on Epic to have this little flashing light. Hey, Deb Cully, your patient has a risk of postoperative delirium tomorrow of 29%. And I would say, oh, got to do something about that. The prior examples that I gave you were really good because they had really well-defined input and output variables. Delirium is just not that wonderful quite yet. The predictors, however, may be in the electronic record. And this would really require that we screen a large number of patients, and you'd need a committed group of people to do so. And I think it's worth doing because even if you didn't reduce the likelihood of developing delirium, you can inform your patients and their families of what their risks are. And I don't know how many of you have had a family member who developed delirium in the course of a hospitalization, but it is horrible for them. I watched my dad go through his dying process, and he was seeing things on the walls. One day he asked me why I was there. Shouldn't I be sleeping? It was the middle of the day. You know, all sorts of things. And I asked him, do you know that this is going on, and does it bother you? He says, oh, yeah, I think I'm going crazy. And maybe, perhaps, as a part of his process, he was, but really, at that point in time, he was delirious. And so as a part of all of those types of things, I find myself dreaming. I'm a big dreamer. You can't get to wherever you're going if you don't dream about the things that don't currently exist. And so one of my dreams is this world where I could predict the number one cause of postoperative morbidity in our older surgical patients with an area under the curve of 0.8. I cannot even imagine how wonderful that would be. And if we could, we would have the opportunity to reduce the risk of delirium by approximately 40%. Now, as somebody had mentioned, I have the privilege of being a director of the American Board of Anesthesiology. We've got two of our biostatisticians that are sitting in the back of the room. You want to stand up for a minute and wave to everybody so that you're not just hidden people out in the nowhere land. These are the people that keep us out of trouble. But we have this component to maintenance of certification, which is MOC, and it requires improvement in medical practice activities. And we've got a lot of hits on these. So we're really trying to make it so that it's more reasonable, easier for you to do as a part of your everyday practice. And I think that MPOG and Aspire are really working to do that type of a thing. And when I think about delirium, I just wonder whether or not if we got that flashing light sitting up there saying there's a 20% chance that your patient might have delirium, and then maybe a little toolbox that said these are the things that you can do to try to reduce the risk of delirium in your older surgical patients, could we have an impact on patient outcomes in one of the most common or most prevalent postoperative complications? This idea of a provider feedback, okay, maybe I can't have it flashing on the wall, although I really want it in Epic to just flash at me so that I know that it's there. Really, I want it to flash for all of you because I'm probably going to be looking for it anyway, so you get the bright flashy lights. But to be able to get an email every month or however often that included, gosh, you know, you had a prevalence of delirium of 28%, I would say, yes, okay, probably I did because almost all of my patients are over 75. But I'd be disappointed because it should be way lower. Somebody who has pediatric patients is going to have an incidence of maybe 5%. They're going to be happy, but maybe they shouldn't because there is this thing called pediatric postoperative delirium. So if we could come up with ways or identify ways to mark those patients that are likely to develop delirium, and I think MPOG is uniquely suited for this, we could really improve patient outcomes. And with that, I know we're running late. I'd like to thank you for being here and willing to listen. And I'd also like to direct you to the Brain Health Initiative through the American Society of Anesthesiology. They're really working very hard to try to improve the postoperative health of our older surgical patients. Any questions? Hi.
Hi. So
I didn't know you'd be here.
So as he said, Brad Fritz, Washington University. So thank you for the wonderful talk. One of the questions that we've been struggling with as well is if you're able to predict some sort of a complication, it's unclear what the person receiving that notification should do with it if we don't have sort of action items based on what's driving the prediction. Do you have any insights or thoughts?
Well, I don't know all the answers because it's a really complicated thing. But the development of a toolbox that could allow people, maybe through MPOG, to identify those things that you could do. So there are a couple of things in our institution that we do. Somebody screens positive for frailty and cognitive impairment. They go and see a geriatrician. In other patient settings, they go and see a neuropsychologist. And then you get groups of people together to decide, along with the patient, whether or not this is the right surgery for them. It's a bizarre concept because you would think initially that surgeons would not want to think about anything that would be related to canceling their case or that maybe a non-surgical option is better. But now that they're starting to be responsible for their outcomes, they're very interested and they want to know. And now I have them kind of coming to me all the time saying, hey Deb, what should I do here? Because they are now hearing information about, you know, your patient stayed in the ICU for 10 extra days or your patient was in the hospital longer than others, and so they're very interested.
Thank you.
Hi. Hey, how are you?
Yeah, thank you.
Do you know
so
by
much,
accident
really.
We just happened to sit next to one another today?
Yeah, that was not intentional, actually. Excellent talk also. I think everybody learned from it. And this was a question also to inject this thought into the group. We discussed this actually at the University of Michigan the other day. But I was wondering, from your standpoint, if you were, say you had an MPOG measure that was going to be delivered to everybody, would you like one that would say, this is the incidence of patients that you had this month that developed delirium? Or would you like one like, say, you avoided a certain type of drug? Does that make sense in your mind?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you had to pick like one of those two things, how would you, because the delirium score is maybe not so good, and the drugs, you know, it's not clear if it's always going to impact, but at least we maybe know like what is actually being delivered in that sense. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense.
Okay.
And I personally would want to know both because I think what's really, no, the unique thing that you're laughing at me. The unique thing about MPOG is that you can put those pieces together. You do a case and now you moved on to your next case and you might have done 20 cases in the course of a week. You don't remember every single time something happened and you might not even have gone up to find out that your patient developed postoperative delirium and you might not remember to whom you gave those drugs to. This gives you a unique opportunity to go into those cases where you might want to rethink what you did. Maybe you did it perfectly fine, but it's always reasonable to rethink what it is that you've done. Good question. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.